Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present to you Peter Vogel, a researcher who is engaged in a long quest for an intellectual and political holy grail, namely the researching of the Port Chicago explosion. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Oh, thanks very much, Dave. It's so kind of you to still be with us after 10 years.
Well, this is a story that you've been following for many years and that I've been following with you for the last 10. Concerns the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship, the E.A. Bryan, right here in Suisun Bay in the Bay Area where I'm based. Why don't we start with your remarkable quest for this particular political and intellectual holy grail with a rummage sale that you attended in which you came across a document at the bottom of a box, the history of the 10,000-ton gadget.
Yeah, I did find that at a rummage sale in Santa Fe, New Mexico in the spring of 1980. It's actually the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church out on the old Pecos Trail. And it was in the bottom of a cardboard box that had mostly photographic supplies in it, which I could look at and identify as being from the 1940s. And then down at the very bottom of this box, there was a number 10 white letter envelope that had a piece of paper folded up inside it. And I took that out and looked at it and realized that I had an atomic bomb document. And the bottom line of that document says, "Ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion."
And this was entitled, actually, the History of the 10,000-Ton Gadget.
Yes, actually it is. Specifically, it's a mathematical model of the plutonium-focused lens atom bomb that was tested at Trinity Site in New Mexico in July of 1945 and then detonated at Nagasaki on the 9th of August.
Now, the Port Chicago, the blast, the mushroom cloud flattens out or mushrooms out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Now, that led you on a quest as to what the Port Chicago explosion was really all about. And you initially hypothesized in your article, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, that was published in the Black Scholars issue of spring of 1982, that this was actually an explosion, perhaps a test of the gun weapon that went off, that was dropped on Hiroshima.
I did at first think it was the gun weapon, the Hiroshima weapon, which in fact apparently was not tested before it was used in combat. Go ahead.
And you began taking a look at the possibility that the gun weapon may have actually, this may have been an explosion of the gun weapon.
Right. It was the ball of fire. The document, of course, says ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. And it was that line, the ball of fire, in connection with the Port Chicago explosion, which was written to be typical of a nuclear explosion, is really what got me into this, because, I mean, I'm not a real physicist, but I know that the thermodynamic characteristics of the ball of fire from a chemical explosion like TNT or dynamite are going to be very, very different from the thermodynamics of an atom bomb. The temperature of the atom bomb is 1,000,000 degrees centigrade, and dynamite doesn't get above 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So they're going to be quite different. And that initially led me to consider that Port Chicago could have been a nuclear test, just based on the fact that the scientists who wrote that document compared the Port Chicago explosion to an atom bomb test.
And one of the things that's interesting was that there was a great deal of interest by personnel working on the Manhattan Project in Port Chicago. And in fact, one of the key figures in your story was the person who actually wrote the report on the Port Chicago explosion for the Los Alamos Laboratory. He later served as the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay and also supervised the crossroads test at the Bikini Atoll.
Yeah, that's Vice Admiral William Sterling Parsons. At the time of World War II, he was a naval captain, was subsequently appointed or elevated to the rank of admiral after the Bikini test. But he was a Navy officer attached to the Manhattan Project, and he was there with General Groves' acceptance of him, and he basically was the senior naval officer that was attached to the Manhattan Project. He was an ordnance officer, really knew how to build big guns and ordnance of all types. And these weapons, the first one especially, was going to be a gun-based device. So he was the right person to be there for that purpose. And he did, in the days following the Port Chicago explosion, go from Los Alamos, the A-bomb laboratory in New Mexico, to Port Chicago with two Los Alamos scientists in his company. And they compiled very extensive reports on the effects of the explosion at Port Chicago, and he synthesized them and sent them to his commanding officer, Rear Admiral William Purnell, who incidentally was a member of President Roosevelt's Atomic Bomb Policy Committee.
And again, bearing in mind that Port Chicago was officially the explosion of an ammunition ship, the mushroom cloud would, and yet the reference in the history of the 10,000-ton gadget said it mushrooms out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Now, bearing in mind that Captain Parsons showed an inordinate, he wrote the report on the Port Chicago explosion, and that Los Alamos showed an inordinate amount of interest in this. One of the factors, that the explanation for not having tested the uranium gun weapon, that was the type of weapon that was dropped on Nagasaki, was that there was not enough uranium available at the time. And yet in your original Black Scholar article, you demonstrated that that was not the case, that there was enough uranium to test a weapon.
Mm-hmm. There certainly was enough material that was available, uranium-enriched in the isotope 235. Certainly was enough material available to test the Hiroshima gun assembly device before it was used in combat, but it really wasn't necessary to test it. The mechanism could and was tested at a small scale at Los Alamos, beginning with 3-inch guns, and then they graduated to a 5-inch gun, which was in fact the bore of the final gun weapon that was used at Hiroshima. So the only thing that they really didn't know about the gun weapon was whether or not the fission material would explode as everyone predicted it would. And so that would be one reason to conduct any kind of a nuclear test that would prove the large-scale potential of nuclear fission.
Briefly, Peter, if you could explain how the gun weapon worked and how that was different from the Nagasaki weapon.
Mm-hmm. The gun weapon was called a gun weapon because it was basically like any kind of a firearm that anyone would be familiar with, or artillery for that matter. It fires a projectile of fissionable material from the breech end of the barrel, which is 5 inches interior diameter, down to the target end, or what would be the muzzle end of the barrel. And at that point, the projectile of uranium merges with a target of uranium, and that's a supercritical mass, and it explodes as an atom bomb.
And then the plutonium implosion weapon operates in a somewhat different fashion. We'll touch on that a little bit later. You cite in your Black Scholar article a number of anomalies with regard to the actual explosion itself and the physical evidence about that that would suggest that the official explanation of conventional explosives as being behind this explosion could not have taken place. One of those was the brilliant white flash, which is characteristic of nuclear explosions but not conventional explosions. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Color and temperature are interrelated. As we all know, you know, hot metal will glow red. If you get metal very, very hot, it'll glow white or yellowish. Now, an atomic bomb explodes and generates a temperature of about 1 million degrees Fahrenheit or centigrade. It doesn't make much difference in the fireball. And that is so hot that it radiates white light. Was characteristic, one of the things that was noticed frequently at Hiroshima, the white flash. And that's because of the temperature of the fireball, and the fireball of chemical explosions like dynamite or TNT will be reddish or orange, red to yellow.
And something else that's characteristic of nuclear explosions on water was the Wilson condensation cloud, and eyewitnesses described just such a phenomenon at Port Chicago. Tell us about that.
Well, that's really an astonishing finding, I feel, in this work. I was reading through the transcript of the Naval Court of Inquiry into the cause of explosion, possible or probable causes. And one of the officers, an Army pilot testified that he was flying his C-49, I believe it was, line of sight toward Port Chicago at a distance of about 7 miles from the explosion when Port Chicago blew up. And he observed and he testified in the court that he saw a donut-shaped ring whoosh out from the center of the explosion to a distance of about 3 miles. That's the diameter, about a mile and a half radius and 3 miles across. And I remembered that I had read about that in a book on the explosions, the nuclear test explosions were conducted at Bikini. And I found a picture of that, and it matched exactly what this pilot at Port Chicago had described to the court.
And that again, the Wilson condensation cloud, characteristic of nuclear explosions over water. Can you briefly tell us what that produces that, again, bearing in mind limitations of time?
Sure. The atmosphere above a large body of water like the Suisun Bay or Bikini Atoll, the lagoon there, the water above that is very highly saturated with water, not quite saturated, but it has a great deal of water content in it. And when the explosion occurs, there is a blast wave, a shock wave, a pressure wave that travels out from the explosion spherically, and it heats the water in the air to the point that it condenses into a fog, a cloud-like formation. And then after the shock wave passes, the temperature cools behind the shock wave, and that's actually when the condensation cloud forms. As the temperature drops in the low pressure following the blast wave.
Alrighty. Explosives experts have pointed out on the basis of explosions of past ammunition ships that only a small percentage of the explosives would have gone off high order. And you present information in your Black Scholar article about Port Chicago that the explosives on board simply would not have accounted for the massive damage both to the facility at Port Chicago and also to the bottom of Suisun Bay.
It did seem to me, on the basis of rough calculations that I can make and by comparison with other large explosions in similar circumstances, it did seem to me that the yield, the energy yield, the damage resulting from the Port Chicago explosion exceeded what would have been possible from the munitions that were in place on the Bryan, the Liberty ship that exploded, and on the dock next to it. It seemed that so much of that ammunition did not explode with its full energy, that it partially burned. And taking that into account, I mean, spent shells, shells that didn't explode, taking all that into account, the energy yield of the explosion and resulting damage was considerably larger than what could actually, in my opinion, have been accounted for by the munitions that were available then.
And other explosives experts have pointed out that only a small percentage of the explosives on board the E.A. Bryan would have gone off high order. The rest would have burned.
They probably did burn. It contributed somewhat to the flash bang of the explosion, but didn't contribute significantly to the formation of the fireball because it was much too cool.
Yeah, the point being that the explosion that resulted could not have been accounted for in all likelihood by the conventional explosions on the ship.
I don't see how. I could never make it add up.
There was a film which also figures into your inquiry, supposedly of a mock-up of Port Chicago, but you developed information that would indicate the possibility that it was actually of the explosion. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, I had been looking for a film. My assumption during all of this time was that Los Alamos and the Navy had, in fact, test-detonated a weapon at Port Chicago. And anything that I could find that would help me understand the explosion was something that was well worth looking into.
And it turns out that the official explanation for this film was that it was a simulation of the Port Chicago explosion to demonstrate why the Port Chicago facility should be incorporated into the Concord Naval Weapons Station. Yet you discovered that the time frame in which the cover story was developed and the type of film that the film was on were divergent, and that the cover story could not have been accurate.
Since I assumed that this thing had been a test, I just couldn't imagine that the test would have been conducted without a motion picture record having been made of the explosion itself. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's reasonable to assume that. I looked through all the national through archives of the Army and the Air Force and the Navy and couldn't find anything. And then one day over at the Concord Naval Weapons Station, talking to the public information officer over there, now retired, Dan Dukowski, I said, I'd really like to find a movie of the Port Chicago explosion to look at. And he said, oh, we have one. And I said, well, I'd really like to see it. He said, why is that? And I said, well, because I believe that it's a film of a nuclear explosion of Fort Chicago. And then he said, well, you can't look at it because it's nitrate-based film. And if we take it out of the safe, it's going to fall apart. So I looked and looked around to try and find any record, other record of that film, and I found that KQED television in San Francisco had seen the film several years earlier, and it actually duplicated that part of the film that shows the formation of the fireball. So I had it. The Navy has told me that the original film has been destroyed when the original was put on videotape, so we'll never be able to look at the original and find out what the whole story was.
The point being, though, that the film was developed at a time when nitrate-based film was no longer being used.
Well, that's true. Nitrate-based film went out in the early 50s, I suppose, because it's explosive. And the cellulose film is now non-explosive, and that's used conventionally and was used since 1952 or thereabouts. So if this film was indeed, as the Navy told me, a nitrate-based film, then it had to have been made in the 40s.
And that was not the official explanation.
That was not. No, they said it was a miniature setup that Hollywood had made and then filmed it to simulate the Port Chicago explosion. But it didn't look like a simulation to me. It still doesn't.
There are a lot of... one of the aspects of your investigation which suggests most strongly to me that you're right on the money in looking for a nuclear explanation for Port Chicago was the elements of cover-up that you engaged in. You showed the paper, the history of the 10,000-ton gadget to Edward Teller, who had a most interesting reaction.
I did. I had the privilege of getting my introduction to physics from Dr. Teller at Berkeley as an undergraduate in the mid-60s, and I knew him pretty well, and I called him up at Los Alamos, or actually at Lawrence Livermore, and made an appointment to meet him when he would be next at Los Alamos in the autumn of 1980. And I went over and met him, and I said, look at this document that I have here, and I started taking his picture, and I said, look at the bottom line, and tell me, please, what it means there where it says ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Well, Ed then said, looked at it for a minute, and he said, oh, it's the Port Arthur, Texas explosion. I said, no, it's not. You know, it's very clearly it says Port Chicago there. Well, then he said, I believe you have a classified document. You should take it over to the classification office at Los Alamos Lab, where we were. I will deny ever having seen this document, and I will deny ever having spoken about Port Chicago with you.
And one wonders, if this was just the explosion of an ammunition ship, what could be more mundane than that, and why did he react that way? We mentioned earlier that Captain Parsons, who was one of the naval officers heavily involved in the Manhattan Project, was the fellow who researched Port Chicago for Los Alamos. And he later turned out to be the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki and later supervised the Operation Crossroads tests at Bikini Atoll. Again, by way of reminding listeners of the inordinate interest in Port Chicago by the people developing the atomic bomb, there was a report about the Port Chicago explosion, the Army and Navy Explosive Safety Board Technical Paper Number 6. Was there not, Peter?
Yes, I believe that was 1947. I don't have the date right in front of me. It's 1947 or 1948. And that was a compilation that was done by the Army-Navy Safety Explosive Safety Board on the Port Chicago explosion. And it put together a great many of the documents and the information that was known about Port Chicago.
And this paper, again, from the late 1940s, was reclassified top secret after the publication of your article in Black Scholar in the spring of 1982.
I had a copy of it because I hadn't told people why I wanted it. It was an unclassified document which I found in one of the Navy archives back in Washington, D.C. And I got a copy of it. There wasn't a problem. As soon as I published information from that document in the spring 1982 issue of the Black Scholar, the document was indeed reclassified and was available thereafter, and still is available only to Department of Defense contractors.
And the point being that in 1982, what could be more mundane than a report about the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship? Why should that have been reclassified after the publication of your article in 1982, almost 40 years later?
Oh, I know. It's astonishing.
It reminds me a little bit of the old Warner Brothers cartoons where you've got Bugs Bunny in a haunted house, you know, and he knocks on a door and goes, "Nyeh, anybody in there?" And a voice goes, "No, there's nobody in here." And it's one of, from an investigative standpoint, I think it's one of the things that argues most strongly for your hypothesis, aside from the physical evidence itself.
Well, let me go back just for a very brief moment to the very beginning of this. After I talked to Dr. Teller at Los Alamos, I then talked to the director of Los Alamos, Donald M. Kerr, Jr., Don Kerr, who incidentally is now the director of the FBI Forensics Laboratory. And I said, "Don, I think that Los Alamos and the United States Navy, nuked Port Chicago." Shortly after that, I learned that there was a large collection of Port Chicago-related documents in the archive at Los Alamos. And those were declassified for me by Los Alamos within a few weeks after I requested them. And the first evidence that I really had that there was a cover-up was the one page that I copied from that vast 600-700 pages of documents. And it says, "Papers showing that that two railroad cars at Port Chicago were loaded, we destroyed." And I looked at that and I thought, well, here's evidence that people are destroying evidence. And So I went at that.
And again, these were documents from Los Alamos.
Yes.
And talking about two railroad cars that were sent to Port Chicago, had the reports on the contents had been destroyed.
That's correct.
Also, another detail we should mention was that the E.A. Bryan had new booms put in to handle much heavier cargo than ordinary shortly before the explosion.
Right. The E.A. Bryan did have 10-ton cargo booms and gear, the cables and so forth that run on these cargo loading booms. Those were installed to be able to load a weight of 10 tons, 10,000 pounds, pardon me. And that was very close to the weight, just above what would be necessary in order to be able to load a completed atomic bomb in its exterior case onto this Liberty ship, the E.A. Bryan. With the booms and gear that the ship had on it when it entered the Port Chicago area, it could not have loaded a completed atomic bomb. It didn't have the gear that was strong enough to load it.
And we should also point out, too, that shortly after Port Chicago, the switch, in fact, I believe it was August of 1944, the switch was made at Los Alamos to research on the gun weapon, to research on the plutonium implosion weapon that was dropped on Nagasaki.
Right. The gun weapon was completely specified. It was indeed ready to go by the time of the Port Chicago explosion and could have been tested at Port Chicago. There's no question about that any longer. There is indeed a possibility that a small-scale version of the gun weapon, the Hiroshima uranium weapon, possibly a hydride, uranium hydride weapon, was tested in the New Mexico desert on the 26th of December 1943. There's pretty strong evidence of a very big explosion down there on that date, and there is documentation that indicates that the decision the following day was made not to further develop a weapon that's defined as a nuclear torpedo.
There was actually an article in the San Francisco Chronicle talking about Captain, this was in August of 1997, which Captain Parsons, this is an article by a researcher named Barton Bernstein at Stanford, talking about Captain Parsons researching the possibility of a nuclear torpedo.
Yes, it could be a code word. There wasn't any kind of a torpedo under development at that point, but Captain Parsons, being a Navy man, was really pushing the concept of a Navy nuclear torpedo. Now, that would probably be a torpedo that would be dropped from a plane rather than a torpedo that would be ejected from a submarine's tube.
And bearing in mind, too, that Captain Parsons, as I've already mentioned, in addition to overseeing the Port Chicago research for Los Alamos, was the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay, and then later supervised the Operation Crossroads tests at Bikini. the Bikini Atoll. Peter, your quest for Port Chicago resulted in a rather strange break-in or two in which you had some research material stolen.
I did. It's so long ago that one tends to forgive. When I was living in Santa Fe in the early 1980s, and I was just beginning to publish this material, it had come out in the Black Scholar, my home in Santa Fe was broken into. A great big old huge back door was just flat down in pieces. It was glass. And most of my valuables, many of my valuables at that time were taken. The second time around, in addition to the second break-in, which followed that by a couple of weeks, in addition to other valuables that still remain, bicycles and musical instruments, the drawer containing most of the important documents on Port Chicago was also removed. Fortunately, I had copies of them put away in a safety deposit box, so there wasn't really any loss.
Well, again, I think this is significant because the fencing value of that report on Port Chicago would have been very low. I don't think it would.
It would be quite high now.
it may be, but I'm just saying that it wouldn't have brought a lot for the average booster on the black market.
Not at all. Well, I, of course, always blame it on my ex-wife.
Well, that may be, but I suspect that there probably was a more sinister explanation for this particular break-in. Peter, we're going to resume with a discussion of your quest for the truth concerning Port Chicago and the other side of the program. I want to remind listeners that there is, in addition to the article on Port Chicago in the spring 1982 issue of the Black Scholar magazine, which it's still in publication, is it not?
Well, I understand that they have copies that they can distribute, yes.
Okay. There's also a program that I did with some supplemental interviews with you back in August of 1988 about Port Chicago, and that's available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. I'll give the particulars for the listeners. Spitfire is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. You can also see a description of and list of the various programs available from Spitfire on the KFJC webpage. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org and look in the public affairs section. This is Dave Emery live in the studio after the conclusion of the Peter Vogel interview. A few corrections and addenda. First of all, I misspoke myself several times in this broadcast. The Enola Gay was actually the B-29 bomber that dropped the U-235 gun weapon on Hiroshima, not Nagasaki. I misspoke myself a couple of times. Also, a couple of points to bring up. The cancer statistics for Alameda County for three of the critical years following Port Chicago are missing. Alameda County has a high incidence of cancer, and the cancer stats for three of the critical years after Port Chicago are missing, yet another indication of a possible cover-up. Also note that a number of the people who had been treated for injuries at Port Chicago showed evidence of flash burns, and that also would shore up the information that this was a nuclear device. The second half of the interview is focusing on Mark II, and that is coming up. My name's Dave Emery. For Peter Vogel, thanks for listening.